You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, the only true liberal network that there is. Thanks to Billy Shears, our music director, and don't forget, you heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you tomorrow, gang. Stay tuned for Mark Levine.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. The state of Israel is 60 years old today, which, of course, prompted Saturday Night Live to say that in 5 years, Israel can move to Florida. And perhaps that would be a safer place for the Jewish state than the land of Judea, from which Jews get their name. But it is true that 60 years ago, on this day, on May 14, 1948, in a very small convention hall in Tel Aviv, and I've been there, David Ben-Gurion declared the creation, or really the reemergence, I should say, of the Jewish state. Now, he had to hide. It was interesting. I went to that museum there, and they had to let the location be known only at the very last minute. He had feared, of course, attack, not so much by the Arabs, though they certainly feared that attack, but more so by the British, who would certainly have arrested David Ben-Gurion for treason. A lot of people forget that the Israeli War of Independence in 1948 was in many ways as much against the British as it was against the Arabs. The British refused to implement the United Nations resolution of November 29, 1947, the one that divided the Western Palestinian lands, then called Palestine, into a Jewish and an Arab state. Even though the majority of the world had voted for it, the Arab states had voted against it, including Britain's client state called Transjordan, the state created in the eastern portion of Palestine, that east of the Jordan River. And Britain wanted to support its client state. It had very much installed the king at the time, King Abdullah, after he was kicked out of a Saudi Arabia. See, Britain had planned to establish the two brothers, the two Hashemite brothers, and as kingdoms in Iraq and Saudi Arabia for them helping Britain in World War I against the Turks. You may have seen some of those travails in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. And so they wanted very much to help their client state, Transjordan, invade and take over. No one seemed to think the Jewish state would last. So Britain, contrary to international law, was not implementing the new Jewish state, and, the Jews were fighting to survive. So there he was, David Ben-Gurion, in a very small land in Tel Aviv, declaring the reemergence of the Jewish state, saying that the inhabitants would be respected no matter what their religion, no matter what their peoplehood, and practically begging the Arab states for peace. Of course, the next day, Israel was invaded by 7 Arab nations. That event happened 60 years ago, and today Israel is certainly a vibrant democracy. It is far from perfect. It has lived in hostility its entire existence. There is, of course, the entire question of the Arab refugees that occurred in the war of 1948 and 49. And I want to discuss all of those things. Palestinians call that event the Nakba, the catastrophe. In fact, they adopted the name Palestinian, though, not till about 16 years later, with the creation of the Palestinian Liberation Organization by Egyptian leader Abdel Nasser as a way to take a certain Cairo-born of Egyptian family by the name of Yasser Arafat. You may be surprised to find out he was born in Cairo, but to use him in order to overthrow the Jewish state. In doing my research for today, I actually came across an old interview that I want to play throughout this broadcast. It's an interview of Mike Wallace, aged 40 then, with then Israel's ambassador to the United States, Abba Eban. And it was on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of Israel. The interview dates from 1958, and it certainly is dated. You can see there are commercials for cigarettes. It is a black and white interview, and yet it's, I guess, interesting how many of the problems remain. At that time, of course, Israel did not have the West Bank. Jerusalem was divided. It did not have the Western Wall. It did not have Gaza. The Arab refugees were living in the refugee camps built for them by Egypt and Jordan. Transjordan changed its name to Jordan after it invaded the West Bank. And neither Egypt nor Jordan, of course, would give the Arab lands they conquered, that were supposed to be Arab lands under the UN resolution, to the people, to the Arab refugees that they stuck in camps. And so the discussion there was, of course, among the Arab countries calling for Israel's destruction. And I guess what's amazing is how much of that interview 50 years ago rings true today. Let me play for you a little bit of that interview, and then I want to talk about the history of the State of Israel for the last 60 years and for the last 4,000 years. And, of course, encourage you to call in with your comments on anything that I've said or any thoughts on the matter. Let me play for you, though, a little bit of this old interview, just to give you a feeling for what was said 50 years ago. And, again, how surprising, at least it was to me, how much of it sounds the same today. It's an old clip, so give it a chance.
Good evening. Tonight, we go after a story that has been thousands of years in the making, the story of Israel, the country which celebrates its 10th anniversary this month. Our guest, Abba Eban, Israel's ambassador to the United States and its chief delegate to the United Nations. If you're curious to hear Ambassador Eban's views on the recent mergers by Arab nations which are hostile to Israel, his views on Egypt's President Nasser and the Arab refugee problem, on American Jewry, and the charge that Israel threatens world peace with a policy of territorial expansion, we'll go after those stories in a moment. My name is Mike Wallace. The cigarette is Parliament.
I will skip the cigarette commercial, though I can tell you that if you want to see the entire interview, I highly recommend it. It's only a half hour long, and it's on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. Mike Wallace asks Abba Eban some very tough questions, I think, and comes after him pretty hard. He begins the interview talking about Nasser. When he talks about the consolidation of Arab countries, right before this interview was taken, the country of Egypt and the country of Syria joined together as the United Arab Republic. In the 1950s, the Arabs insisted that there was no separation of Arab peoples, that there should be one giant Arab state, that Egypt and Syria, Iraq, Jordan, that all of those lands were Arab lands, really everyone from Morocco to Saudi Arabia all the way east to Pakistan were all part of one large Arab national community, and it was considered against Arab nationalism to separate the people into Egyptians and Moroccans and so forth and Libyans. So Egypt and Syria combined together in the United Arab Republic, and the first question that Mike Wallace asked Abba Eban at the time is about that combination, the threat it is to Israel, and Abba Eban responds that if Egypt will leave Israel alone, Israel would certainly be happy to live in peace. I don't play that portion because the sound quality is not very good for radio. Again, though, if you want to hear it yourself, just go to my website and check it out. I want to play the portion dealing with the Arab refugees because I found that particularly interesting.
Let's take a look at them. First, the refugee problem. An estimated 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were left homeless during the Arab-Israeli War of 48. Israel refuses to readmit them. They live in bitterness, and such men as historian Arnold Toynbee has said this: the evil deeds committed by the Zionist Jews against the Arabs are comparable to crimes committed against the Jews by the Nazis. How do you feel about that?
Well, about Professor Toynbee's statement, I can only repeat what I've written, that it is a monstrous blasphemy. Here he takes the massacre of millions of our men, women, and children, and he compares it to the plight of Arab refugees alive on their kindred soil, suffering certain anguish, but of course possessed of the supreme gift of life. This equation between massacre and temporary suffering, which can easily be alleviated, is, I think, a distortion of any historic perspective. But the refugee problem, Mr. Wallace, isn't the cause of tension. The refugee problem is the result of an Arab policy which created the problem by the invasion of Israel, which perpetuates it by refusing to accommodate them into their expanding labor market, and which refuses to solve a problem which they have the full capacity to solve. There is, I think, a basic immorality in this attitude of Arab governments to their own kinsmen, whose plight they could relieve immediately once the will to relieve it existed. All world opinion admits that the problem can only be solved on a regional basis by opening the vast resources of the Arab world to this Arab refugee population, and if there were such an effort on their part to approach a regional settlement, Israel would make its due and just contribution.
Of course, the problem of the refugees is allied with the problem of territorial expansion on the part of Israel. A major Arab spokesman here in the United States, Dr. Fayez Saeed, says this. He says the area of the territories held by Israel today exceeds by about 40% the area of the territories given Israel by the United Nations.
Let me just stop there and explain what he's talking about. This, again, this interview occurred in 1958. What Mike Wallace is talking about is that under the 1947 United Nations resolution, the remainder of Palestine, that west of the Jordan River, was divided into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jewish community, the Jewish agency, the one in charge of the Israeli Jewish community at the time, accepted the deal. The Arabs rejected the deal and invaded. And in response, Israel took over the lands that would become the State of Israel from 1948 to 1967. That's what he's referring to. This is, of course, before the 67 war. Before that Arab attack led to Israel taking the West Bank and Gaza. Let's hear. I just want to explain that before we continue.
Most of this added area, he says, was taken by force and should therefore be relinquished by Israel.
Well, I think this gentleman need not lose any sleep at night worrying about whether the state of Israel is too big. Really, there is nothing more grotesque or eccentric in the international life of our times than the doctrine that little Israel, 8,000 square miles in area, should become even smaller in order that the vast Arab empire should still further expand.
Just to get an idea, 8,000 square miles, I looked it up, is smaller than New Jersey. The entire state of Israel in the old 67 borders was smaller, about 10% smaller than the state of New Jersey, just to give you an idea of its size.
There are really two aspects, Mr. Wallace, to every territorial problem, the legal aspect and the moral aspect. The law is clear. The present territorial frontiers rest on agreements between Israel and the Arab states, which cannot be changed except by consent. The Arab states have signed those agreements, which give them and us a veto power against any territorial change to which we do not agree, so that there's no legal abuse in the present situation.
Well, you and the Arabs have hardly signed a territorial agreement.
Oh, we have,
that
yes.
Involves what territory Israel took as a result of the 48 war.
Oh, yes, we have. The present agreements between Israel and the Arab states delimit the precise territory which we hold now. Israel does not possess a single inch of territory beyond the valid agreements which she has signed and which the United Nations has ratified. And
under the terms of an armistice,
yes,
pending final settlement.
Yes, but in that final settlement, as it is written in the agreements, no changes can be accepted without the consent of both parties.
So what they're talking about is the armistice agreements of 1949, where the Arab states did not agree to the existence of Israel, but simply agreed on the lines which would preclude further fighting at the time, sort of like the border separating North Korea and South Korea, or for that matter, the line of control between India and Pakistan. It's sort of a de facto recognition of where everything is. A lot I found very interesting in that the discussion of the Arab refugees is very interesting. Abba Iban pointing out that those refugees were not taken in by the vast Arab countries. That, I should make clear, is an exception in world history. Indeed, I'm not sure I know of another example. If you look at what happened, for example, in 1946 and 1947, the 2 years before Israel was created, the British also controlled a vast swath of territory in British India. And British India today consists of the countries of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Those countries had large numbers of Hindus and large numbers of Muslims. And Britain ruled over it as one consolidated entity, much as they ruled over one consolidated Palestine. Well, when British left the area, the Hindus and Muslims did not want to live together in one state, and so there was immense fighting, and there was separation, and the countries of India and Pakistan were born. Actually, Bangladesh was born as East Pakistan and later separated from Pakistan, much perhaps as the West Bank and Gaza are ruled by different people today. But in any case, what's interesting in that is that when India and Pakistan separated, tens of millions of refugees, more than 20 million refugees from each country went to the other country. More than 20 million Hindus did not want to live in a Muslim state of Pakistan and left, pack up their bags and left. India took them in. They didn't put them in refugee camps. They allowed them to become full Indian citizens. And more than 20 million Muslims did not want to live in India, packed up their bags and left, and became full and complete citizens of Pakistan. Now, to be clear, there are about 100 million Muslims in India that did not leave, that remain today. In fact, India, although it has a Hindu majority, is the largest Muslim state in the world. So certainly the Muslims that have stayed have remained part of the Indian democracy. But those that left did become full citizens of Pakistan. It's interesting because at the time of 1948, of course, there was another exchange of refugees. 600,000, 700,000 or so Arab refugees decided to leave. Some would say they were forced out. It depends, of course, on who you talk to and the individual situations. Certainly there were cases, I can think of two, in Lod and in Deir Yassin, where the city of Jerusalem was under siege. It was the policy of Transjordan, the British-trained army of Transjordan, to conquer Jerusalem, even though Jerusalem was supposed to be an international city. And the ancient Jewish community of Jerusalem in the Old City, which had been there for 4,000 years, was under siege. The people were starving, and Israel was struggling mightily to get through. And two cities, really not cities, towns, Deir Yassin was a mere village, on the road to Jerusalem, were attacked. They attacked the Jewish, soon-to-be Israeli troops that came in to free Jerusalem, and they fought back. So in those cases, clearly, there was an attack on the villagers, although one could argue it was in self-defense. In any case, most, I think, were simply afraid. Most, like in India and Pakistan, left because they feared for the future. Certainly the Arab states had said that all the Arabs in the land should leave. They issued from their high command, "We're going to throw the Jews into the sea. We won't distinguish between Arab and Jew." And they told the Arabs to leave. And in doing so, of course, many, many did. However, those that stayed, the 160,000 or so Arabs that stayed in Israel, remained and to this day participate in the Israeli democracy. There have been some complaints by Arabs in Israel living in the Jewish state, but what I find interesting is how few of them want to live under a Palestinian authority. I've been to the Israeli Arab town, the largest fully Arab town of Umm al-Fahm, which is about 5 miles from the West Bank. There's certainly cities like Jerusalem and Haifa that are mixed Arab and Jewish. But in this town, Umm al-Fahm is the largest purely Arab town. And as I said, it just happened to land after the 48-49 war on the Israeli side of the border. And at the time of the Camp David agreements, when Barak offered Arafat some 95% of the West Bank, it was suggested that he give Umm al-Fahm, this Arab neighborhood that had been in Israel since 1948, that be given, even though it wasn't part of the West Bank, in exchange for allowing a certain Jewish-settled parts of the West Bank to be part of Israel. And Arafat, it's not clear whether he was interested. Of course, he rejected the entire deal. But the mayor of Umm al-Fahm gave a very strong protest, led a very strong protest of him and his villagers, all Arab, saying that this was racist, that he was as fully Israeli as any Jew, that he was a citizen of Israel, and how dare Israel even consider transferring this Arab town in Israel to an Arab state. He was an Israeli citizen. He had full democratic rights as an Israeli citizen, and his town wanted to remain in the state of Israel. And that, of course, closed off discussion of that. Of course, so the Arabs that stayed in Israel are much like the Muslims that stayed in India. They are a minority, but they fully participate in a democratic state. The history of the state of Israel is very interesting, and I also will definitely get to the present. I want to talk about George Bush and the situation in Lebanon. There's a lot more to focus on. But in terms of the history, it is interesting because I remember reading the declaration 60 years ago of Ben-Gurion talking about the rebirth of the Jewish state, and that's very much how he saw it. He points out that the Jewish state is thousands of years old, indeed older than other nations that are often thought of, England or France or nations that are a mere thousand years old. In fact, I think it could be argued that with the possible, I think China and India are probably older, but the Judean peoples, from which the name Jew comes from, are probably the third oldest state where the people have remained in the state. The Babylonians are with us no more, the Hittites are with us no more, in terms of a similar culture. But in making that declaration, I think he harkens back to, well, to all of Jewish history. And it's I think, amazing when you think about what happened over the last 60 years and what happened before then. There was a time, I hasten to add, when neither the British nor the Arabs were opposed to a Jewish state. I think back to World War I, when you had the Balfour Declaration. Basically, you have to remember that before World War I, all of these territories, virtually every one of them, were controlled by the Turks, controlled by the Ottoman Empire, which had conquered most of them in the 1500s. And that would include what is today Saudi Arabia and Iraq, as well as Syria and Jordan and Israel and most of Egypt. And frankly, for that matter, Bulgaria and Hungary and Greece and Romania, a lot of Eastern Europe as well. And the Ottomans controlled the area right up to World War I, when Turkey made the terrible mistake on their part of joining with the Germans on their side in World War I. Of course, the English and the French won the war. And in doing so, they wanted the support of the native inhabitants. They wanted the support of the Arabs. Certainly, that's where you find T.E. Lawrence and Lawrence of Arabia trying to get the support of the Arabs against the Turks. You've probably read about that or seen the movie. And they wanted the support of the Jews who lived there in Judea. The Zionist enterprise had been going pretty full force for about 40 years at that point, and they were draining the deserts and buying land and doing so in a way. And of course, the Jews were the largest population in Jerusalem and had been for centuries. So they wanted their support too. So they basically offered both the Jews and the Arabs states. They offered states for the people who helped them, the Arabs that helped them, and for the Jews that helped them. And the Jewish state was to be in Palestine. Now, Palestine at the time of the Balfour Declaration would include what is today Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, and the Golan Heights. A lot of people don't realize that the 80% that is east of the Jordan River was always part of historic Palestine. But actually, if you go back to your Bible, you can see that those lands east of the Jordan River were always considered part of Judea. In fact, the oldest term for the Jewish people is Hebrew, which in Hebrew is Ivri. Ivri means across. And it's because the Jews came from the east, came from Jordan across. Now, of course, in Jewish tradition, they were slaves in Egypt, but maybe they just didn't ask for directions. As they wandered 40 years in the desert, it is believed, in fact, that they came in from the east rather than from the west. In any case, all of that land was considered to be the state for the Jewish homeland, and Chaim Weizmann, who was to be the first Israeli president, made a deal with King Faisal. Faisal was the king that would later rule over Saudi Arabia. And neither of them had a state. You have to realize that not only was there no Jewish state, there was no Arab state either. And, of course, you had some 40 million Arabs who wanted a state, as well as the hundreds of thousands of Jews. So clearly there were much larger Arab lands, and the Arabs wanted a state. And they decided to have a united front. And what happened from that was the Weizmann-Faisal Agreement, which I advise you to take a look. And basically, they agreed to support each other's aims. The Jews would support Arab states in what was the former Ottoman Empire, and the Arabs would support a Jewish state in Palestine. And unfortunately, at the time, the British didn't accept that agreement. Had they done so, perhaps we wouldn't have all the controversy that we have today. And the agreement broke down. But at that time, it's very interesting, because if you look at international law, there was an international organization. It was the League of Nations. And that, of course, predated the United Nations. You may recall this was Woodrow Wilson's great plan, even though the United States never joined the League of Nations. But the League of Nations took the Balfour Declaration, and understanding it to be an agreement among Britain, the Jews, and the Arabs, which were frankly the only three people who were there, made it part of international law. And so the British government, as the mandatory authority of the Mandate of Palestine, under the mandate of the League of Nations, under this Balfour Declaration, was supposed to help a Jewish immigration and also to help create Arab states in Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and so forth. Well, the British did their job, let's just say, not as effectively as one would hope, much as they ruled pretty harshly in India. They did the same in the Palestine mandate. First thing they did is they separated it into two. In 1922, they took the eastern portion east of the Jordan River and declared it off settlement to Jews. This would be the Arab state, and this was the country of Transjordan. the same country where they trained its king and that invaded the new state of Israel in 1948. And once it conquered the West Bank, renamed itself Jordan. It was not only across the Jordan River, it was on both sides of the Jordan River. They also gave up the Golan Heights to the French, who at that time were in control of Syria and Lebanon, and then they left the remaining part of Palestine. And then came the 1930s, of course, then came the Nazis, then came boatloads and boatloads of Jewish refugees to Palestine. And Britain promptly, and why they did this, well, you'll have to ask the British of the time. Most believe it's anti-Semitism, but what the British did is turn those boats around in violation of international law, in violation of the League of Nations. They took all those Jewish refugees and gave them to the Nazis, where they were promptly gassed. Not one of the best examples of British goodness, shall we say. But Britain was really doing no more than the rest of the world was doing. The entire world, of course, had closed its doors, including the United States. Every single country on earth, there were boatloads of Jews trying to escape the Nazi gas chambers, and every single country on earth, including the United States, turned them away. So you had Jewish communities that had lived in Germany, in England, in Poland for 1,000 years, and they were suddenly stateless. They had no place to live. They had no place to go. They went to the ancient Jewish homeland in Judea, then called Palestine, and the British turned them away. So most scholars that I've read think that about 2 million of the 6 million could have lived if Britain had followed international law. But they didn't. We all know what happened in the Holocaust. And then came the events of 46, 47, 48 that I've talked about. A lot of people also don't realize the Jewish refugees from Arab countries. Some people are under the misimpression that Israel is a primarily European state. And it is true that approximately 40, even maybe as high as 45% of the Israeli population is descendant of European Jews. Jews like Abba Iban, who came from Great Britain. That's why he has the British accent. Jews from descendants of the Holocaust, Poland, Germany, so forth. And that is about 45% of the Jewish population of Israel. A large portion today comes from Russia. Many have escaped or left Russia right after Russia became no longer communist. But 55% of Israel is the Sephardim, are descendants of either the native Arab Jews who lived there for generations or of the large Arab communities of Iraq and Syria and Egypt and Iran and other Arab nations, Yemen, for example, where they had lived for thousands of years. The Iraqi Jewish community, in fact, is as old as the Babylonian exile. If you read the Bible, you know that the first time the Jews were exiled from the state that King David created, east and west of the Jordan River in Judea, they went to Babylonia. In fact, what's interesting, of course, is that King David's kingdom was separated by the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. You know, he had lots of sons who couldn't agree. And so Israel, the northern kingdom, was destroyed by the Assyrians, and yet that's the name that was chosen for the new Jewish state. The Judean portion lasted longer and is the source of the word Jew. I always find it interesting that most religions get their name from their religion. Most peoples, most ethnicities, get the name from their land. If Christianity, that comes, of course, from Christ, which is the Greek word for Messiah. Christos. So Christianity is understandably named for its founder, Jesus, who was declared as the Messiah. Islam means submission to Allah. Again, it is a religious term, and that makes sense. Buddhism comes from the Buddha, and so forth. Whereas peoples are often given the name of their land. Arabs come from Arabia. The French come from France. The Angles became England, and so forth. And what's interesting about the Jews is, of course, they have more than one name. Jew comes from Judea, comes from the land. In fact, Hebrew, Ivri, again suggests the land coming from across. And Israel is really the religious name, interestingly enough. Even though Jews is the religion today, it comes from the land of Judea, the tribe of Judah, the one leftover remnant. The Israel, that name, Yisrael, means struggles with God. Comes from the story of Jacob struggling with the angel. So Israel, ironically, even though it's a secular democratic state, and we speak of the land of Israel, actually has a religious context. Jews are a strange people. We are both a nation and a religion. And sometimes they come into conflict. There are people who do not agree with the Jewish religion who are born of the Jewish people. And just as there are people who are Arab but not Muslim. And I guess it's possible, though I don't know too many, but there are certainly those of the Jewish religion who don't choose to be part of the Jewish people. That would be like someone who is a Muslim but not Arab. And there's certainly some of those can exist. Anyway, back 2,500 years ago, during the Babylonian exile, the Jewish community of Israel was sent east to Babylon. Babylon eventually became the country of Iraq. Some never left. The Jewish community of Iraq, the Jewish community of Babylonia, literally dates back 2,600 years. In fact, the Talmud, the great Jewish law book written after the Bible, was very much written in Babylonia. They even call it the Babylonian Talmud. So this great Jewish historical document, second only to the Bible, to the Torah, was written in what is today Iraq. Well, after Israel's founding in that year or so, Iraq managed to expel its 120,000 Jews, and they, of course, settled in the land of Israel. The reason I bring it up is because I think refugee movements, as horrific as they often are, usually come to an end when the refugees' people accept them as their own. As I said, the Indians, the people of India accepted, the country of India accepted the Hindu refugees from Pakistan. Pakistan accepted the Muslim refugees from India. Israel accepted the Jewish refugees from Iraq. But Iraq, and Jordan, and Egypt, and Syria, and Lebanon refused to accept the Arab refugees from the land that became Israel. This, I would argue, is a historical anomaly. I don't think you'll find many examples of that in history. Egypt, of course, had conquered the Gaza Strip. Now, Egypt had no right under international law to the Gaza Strip. That was supposed to be a Palestinian Arab state. Transjordan conquered the West Bank with Great Britain's help. But that was not supposed to be belonging to Transjordan. That was supposed to be an independent Arab state. And they took the Arab refugees from what became the state of Israel. And instead of letting them settle a few miles away in Gaza or the West Bank, remember, the borders of the West Bank and Israel were defined by armistice lines, defined where, you know, the troops stopped fighting, like a trench in South Korea, North Korea, or in Belgium in World War I. Some of them had just moved a few miles away. Transjordan, which took over the West Bank, became the country of Jordan, did not allow them to settle. They put them in refugee camps. Actually, Egypt was much worse. Later on, Jordan would accept the Arabs as as citizens. In fact, Jordan is the only country to accept Arab Palestinians as citizens of their country, probably because Jordan is made up of the eastern, what's considered eastern Palestine. Egypt absolutely refused, and Nasser ruled over Gaza with an iron hand. And indeed, one of the reasons why Gaza is such a horrible place today is because a lot of people were packed in a very small area and were kept there in refugee camps by the iron hand of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian dictator. But what I find interesting about this interview with Abba Iban, the interview 10 years after the birth of Israel, 50 years ago, is how the issues really haven't changed that much. He talks about the Arab state that want to destroy the state of Israel and how Israel would just as soon leave everything alone and live in peace. Let me play a little bit more of that interview for you.
So we are within our rights and they are within their rights in accepting or refusing any change. So there's nothing whatever illegal about any aspect of the present territorial question, but the moral issue is the most important here.
Well, now that's the point that I would like to talk to, if I may. The fact remains, when we talk about morality, the fact remains that Israel benefited territorially from a war, from armed violence.
Yes, I'm glad to say that I hope that whenever countries wage a war of aggression, as the Arab states did, that they should be the losers by waging that war of aggression.
Well, as a member of the Judaic faith, which cherishes social justice and morality, Do you believe that any country should profit territorially from violence?
Mr. Wallace, I'm not going into the history of other countries, and I'm not going to analyze how the frontiers of countries which I've seen or in which I've served were achieved. But we have certainly achieved our territorial settlement as a result of agreements, not as a result of violence.
Well, he's hedging a little there. I mean, what he's saying, obviously, is that there are many countries that have achieved their territories through the result of violence. The most recent example in his time, of course, would be the taking of about one-third of Germany after World War II and giving it to Poland. Now, these are lands that have been German for hundreds of years, but Nazi Germany waged an aggressive war against Poland, and Poland took the lands, and millions of Volksdeutsch, millions of Germans, were forced to leave their land where they had lived for hundreds of years, for centuries, and forced to march west back to Germany. And Germany didn't put them in camp. They actually accepted these Germans as part of Germany. Of course, it was under Allied occupied control at the time, so that may be one of the reasons why. But certainly, you know, Israel was born in bloodshed. Yes, there were agreements. Yes, there were armistices with the Arab countries. But I think he's making a little light of the very bloody war of 1948. Interestingly, 1% of the Israeli population died in that war. That's a tremendous loss. I mean, in America, 1% would be 3 million people. If we were to lose 1% of our population here in the United States of America, it'd be 3 million people. One out of every 100 Israelis died in that very, very brutal, bloody war. There are lots of stories of it. Again, 60 years ago, one is of Yad Mordechai, for example, a kibbutz established by Warsaw ghetto survivors, the same people who had managed and there were very few Warsaw ghetto survivors, but the few that remained established this kibbutz in Israel. These are the ones who tried to rise up against the Nazis. Of course, you know, way more than 90% of them were gassed. But they had established the kibbutz, and they were largely the ones who blunted the Egyptian army, which had already conquered Gaza and was heading toward Tel Aviv, and this small kibbutz, Yad Mordechai, managed to stop them. My own cousin tells the story of he was up in the north in a kibbutz, and he says that they didn't have any weapons, but what they would do to protect their kibbutz from being invaded by Arabs is they would pop paper bags. And the popping of the paper bags sounded like guns, and by doing that, they managed to scare the Arabs away. That's my own personal story, which, again, it sort of shows the amazing element of the time. Again, what a different world we'd be in if the Arabs had not invaded, had simply accepted a two-state solution. And I think that really relates to today. Still, I think the answer, whether in 1920 or 1948 or 1939, I didn't mention 1939. In 1939, the Jews were offered a tiny sliver of land, smaller than Rhode Island, basically Haifa and the suburbs around Haifa, not even just barely reaching to Tel Aviv. And that's called the Peel Partition Plan. And they accepted even that because they wanted to gather in the people who were escaping the Nazis. And, of course, the Arabs refused even that. I've always felt that a two-state solution is the right answer. I feel that way today. And, of course, the problem continues. I want to play a little bit more from the interview, and then I want to move to the present day and talk about George Bush, what he's done or hasn't done to resolve the situation in the Middle East. I do want to say, if you want to call in and talk about anything I've talked about, I encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. But let me go back and play a little bit more of the interview with Abba Eban.
It was they who decreed the method by which the present frontiers were achieved. They rejected the 1947 recommendation. We said, let us have boundaries by international agreement. They said, let us fix our boundaries by war. And they made the war. But following the war, we reached agreements, and these agreements define our boundaries. And we and they have agreed that they may not be changed except by mutual consent. But much more important, even than history and law, is this basic moral question. Here we are, 8,000 square miles, perhaps the smallest state in the international community. Here they are, 11 sovereign states, 3 million square miles, 400 times our area, and we have the fantastic doctrine. I will admit it isn't sponsored by any serious government, but one does hear it. The doctrine that this vast, sated, fat, huge, lavish Arab empire should expand at the expense of tiny Israel. Nobody in the world need lie awake at night worrying about whether Israel is too big.
When you talk about the huge, sated, fat Arab states, the 11 sovereign states, it is barely possible that you're guilty of some overstatement. There is also in that area tremendous poverty, tremendous desolation.
Yes, I'm speaking, Mr. Wallace, purely in territorial terms. They really have no reason to envy us, our 8,000 square miles.
Mr. Ambassador, do you foresee further territorial expansion by Israel?
Well, I don't like the word further, Mr. Wallace, because, as I've said, our present boundaries rest upon agreements beyond which we have not encroached. But we certainly do not desire to expand our frontiers. I doubt the reality of this issue. We are prepared to accept a guaranteed settlement with the Arab states on the present frontiers. Are they so prepared? I wonder whether the issue isn't one of Arab expansion. Here sit I, the accredited representative of Israel, and I declare that Israel will sign a peace treaty with the Arab states on the present frontier. Now, you get an Arab ambassador sitting here to say that he will have a settlement with Israel on the present frontier, and you'll really have a story.
Of course, there is one political party, and a fairly substantial political party within Israel, the Herut.
He goes on, Mike Wallace, to point out that there is 15% of the Israeli parliament that does want territory expansion. But again, I find it very interesting because the exact same issues raised today were raised 50 years ago when Israel was just 10 years old. Israel was saying, basically, leave us alone, stop attacking us, and we're happy where we are. And I don't know that its policy has changed too much today. Certainly Israel is far more powerful today than it was then. But so are the Arab states as well, are very powerful, more powerful. In fact, many of them are developing nuclear weapons, not just Iran. But I read the other day in the Washington Post about a whole host of countries, from Syria to Saudi Arabia. We know about Syria, but to Saudi Arabia, to even a relatively peaceful country like Morocco that are looking at nuclear power. The French are helping them build, as well as the North Koreans. It does lead to a scary world. And it seems to me that at the end of the day, the question is, will there ever be peace in the Middle East? Well, most Israelis think not. If you look at the polls of Israelis, prior to Camp David, there was a lot of optimism. At the time of the 1993 Oslo Accords, in fact, which were supported by the majority of Israelis, were supported by AIPAC, and which really fundamentally changed the Middle East. Prior to 1993, the Arabs who lived in the land had stones, and that was the first intifada, and they certainly were unhappy, and they certainly threw their stones, and their stones killed a few people, but not that many. They didn't have arms. They didn't have rockets. They had stones. And Israel, as a way to give the Palestinians a state, set up the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords allowed 50,000 members of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, Yasser Arafat's group, then living in complete exile in Tunis, to return and to bring for the first time large caches of weapons to the Palestinian territories. Now, in hindsight, that looks like a colossal error, because those weapons are currently being used. In fact, a woman in Sidi Rout was killed just the other day. But at the time, I remember very much supporting the Oslo Accords. As I said, even AIPAC supported the Oslo Accords. Israel supported the Oslo Accords. It was seen as a way to finally create a Palestinian state. The Palestinians agreed to forswear violence. This was a major change in the policy of Yasser Arafat. And to accept the Jewish state, and in return, Israel agreed to withdraw from most of the lands, the inhabited lands of the West Bank and Gaza. And, of course, Israel did so, withdrew its troops from the cities back in Oslo. Some 98% of Palestinians were ruled by themselves in the West Bank and Gaza as a prelude to a further accord. And then came Camp David.
15 seats in your parliament to...
Excuse me, didn't mean to start that again. And then came, of course, the Camp David Accords and the colossal error, if it was an error, of Yasser Arafat in refusing to accept the lands offered, refusing to accept a Palestinian state on 95%, 96% of the West Bank, all of Gaza, all contiguous, not cantons, as some Palestinians have said today. In fact, if you look at the Palestinian map put out by the Orient House, yes, Bill Clinton isn't lying, Dennis Ross isn't lying, the Palestinian negotiators aren't lying as of that time when they say the amazing offer offered by Barak. Jimmy Carter, who was never there, has claimed something different, but all of the parties that were there, Israel, Palestinians, and the Americans, all agree that 96% or so of the West Bank, some say 97, some say 95, was offered in a contiguous state and 100% of Gaza. Arafat said no. And Arafat said no because, well, Arafat was corrupt. Arafat had billions of dollars in Swiss and European bank accounts. Arafat knew that if he died without a Palestinian state, he would be a martyr. He'd be remembered fondly by the Palestinian Arab people. Whereas if he controlled a state, then, hey, like Lech Walesa in Poland, he'd have to worry about the sewers and the educational system and everything like that. He also, some say, was a coward in that he feared he would have been assassinated, and perhaps he would have been. Of course, a true leader, look at Martin Luther King, for example, a true leader recognizes that the will of his people and the well-being of his people is more important than his own life. In any case, whether out of cowardice or out of corruption, Arafat refused the best deal the Palestinians have been offered since 1968, when Israel offered at that time to give up the entire West Bank in Gaza, and the Arab population said no. Was offered a pretty good deal, and he said no. And not only did he say no, but he didn't come back with any counteroffer. Even when, according to Bill Clinton, Arabs were to get the Temple Mount, the holiest Jewish site in the world. Well, when that deal was offered and Arafat said no, it pretty much led to the destruction of the Israeli left. At that time, I think the idea that there might be peace in our generation was dashed. It was understood by most Israelis that, oh, I guess they really don't want a state after all. Then came the presidency of George Bush. Now, George Bush is seen by many Republicans, by many Jews, as a friend of Israel. I would argue he is not. I would argue that George Bush has put Israel into more danger than, I don't know. Israel's always been in danger, but definitely more danger than it was 10 years ago. If you listen to, for example, a man by the name of Daniel Kurtzer. He was George Bush's first-term ambassador to Israel. This is, again, George Bush's ambassador, who says, quote, "The sum total is that if you measure Israeli security at the beginning of this administration, at the end of this administration, based on things the president either could have done, should have done, or failed to do, the report card is pretty negative." Kurtzer now works for Barack Obama. Why is it negative? Well, because our invasion of Iraq was very dangerous to Israel. It made Israel's nemesis, Iran, extremely powerful by taking away Iran's counterweight in Saddam Hussein. It also is flooding Arab countries with Iraqi refugees, most notably Jordan, which is a fairly stable dictatorship, a relatively benevolent monarchy, considering the other dictatorships in the Middle East, is being stabilized. It also, I think, strengthens radical elements in the Middle East because it shows the United States attacking a country that never attacked us. So it's fascinating to me when people talk about what a good friend Bush is from Israel. Israel could have much better friends. Israel would have a much better friend who recognized that a two-state solution is not only the answer, but also the answer is not to take unilateral actions like invading countries that never attacked us without any reason for doing so. What's interesting to me is that if you look at wars of self-defense, whether it's our war against the Taliban in Afghanistan or, frankly, Israel's bombing of the Syrian nuclear reactor, if you show the smoking gun evidence to the world, there really isn't complaint. I don't hear that many people, even in the Arab world, complaining about the United States invasion of Afghanistan. There are some, but most understand we were attacked. 3,000 innocent Americans were killed. We had a right to self-defense. Syria hasn't even complained about Israel's bombing of Syria. because they were caught red-handed. In fact, after Israel bombed Syria's nuclear plant, as they were clearing the debris away, the reactor was exposed to the air, and even the International Atomic Energy Agency discovered that Syria had a nuclear weapon. And interestingly, no one has complained about that attack. No, the complaint comes when countries attack that it's not in self-defense. And that's why I think George Bush has harmed Israel, has harmed our entire interest in the region by the war in Iraq. So what are we to think about the situation today? Here we are, 60 years, Israel is 60 today. It's Prime Minister Olmert. He's in trouble. He may be removed from office. He may have to resign out of corruption. That, I don't think, is of major concern. Interestingly, it's Israel has so much more stringent corruption standards than the United States that virtually all of their prime ministers get in some trouble or another. Yitzhak Rabin, great hero of the left, of course, assassinated by a crazy ultra-right-wing Israeli. He himself was removed from office in 1974 because of his corruption. And what are these corruption things? Mostly it has to do with political campaigns. Mostly it has to do with getting money from foreign donors. Now, virtually every American president has gotten money from foreign donors. I can talk about Johnny Chung for the Clintons. For George Herbert Walker Bush, nothing less than the crazy self-proclaimed Messiah, Reverend Sun Myung Moon, gave George Bush Sr. $3.5 million. And while most Americans don't even know about it, few complain about that kind of corruption. I think it's terrific that Israel has such strong standards. And if they get rid of Olmert, it's fine by me. I think actually it shows the strength of their democracy and the difference between a democracy and dictators. When dictators fall, countries are in convulsion. It's unclear who will succeed whom. In a democracy, well, there can just be another election. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, there is real danger. In Lebanon, we have Hezbollah, controlled, financed, armed by Iran, ready to overthrow the country. Iran and Syria are trying to overthrow. And what's interesting in Lebanon is a democracy as well. Now, it's a new democracy. Lebanon has tried. Lebanon used to be called the Beirut of the Middle East. It, of course, fell apart in civil war in the 70s. But its new democracy was elected by the people of Lebanon and was doing just fine, was actually fairly moderate. And, of course, Iran and Syria don't like that, and they're trying to overthrow Lebanon. And that's a real problem, and a really scary problem. And you don't see, though, much world response to that. And I've always found that very interesting. That here you had a United Nations resolution that convinced Israel to stop its war of self-defense when Hezbollah started attacking Israel. And that UN resolution said that Hezbollah would be disarmed, and it put more than 10,000 international troops in southern Lebanon. And what do those troops do today? Well, they sit there in their barracks while Hezbollah takes over the elected government of Lebanon. They simply are disobeying the United Nations resolution to disarm them. And so all this talk about United Nations resolutions is very interesting because, well, some are followed and some are not. So what is to be said about the Palestinian Arabs living 60 years after the Nakba, what they call the catastrophe? Well, the answer is it depends on where they live. In Israel, the Israeli Arabs have full democratic rights. They are a minority, like the Muslims of India, but that's the way it is. People live as minority religions in countries. There is some question about fairness, and if there is, well, they can go to the Israeli Supreme Court and have won many victories there. They are truly doing best of all. Next best would be the Arabs of the West Bank. They are ruled by the Palestinian Authority, by Abbas. He is corrupt, but not more corrupt than Arafat. Actually, I think less corrupt. The whole Palestinian Authority is simply rife with corruption. I don't think the man is personally corrupt. I need to take that back. But I think his government is. In any case, though, I think Abbas is trying. I really do. I think he truly wants peace. He's just not strong enough. And Israel has a terrific dilemma. They can give Abbas arms, which Abbas says he needs to keep down the radical elements in the West Bank, to keep down those that want to have violence against civilians. And that would make sense, except that the last time Israel gave a lot of arms to the Palestinian Authority to keep the peace. Well, that was in Gaza, and Hamas took over in a coup d'etat and took over those arms. In Gaza, of course, it's worst of all for the Palestinians. There, although the Hamas government was originally elected with 43% of the vote, not a majority, but hey, you know, we've seen those kinds of elections before. It happened in our country. Even though Hamas was elected, a year later they did a coup d'etat and they took over the entire government. So those that say Hamas is legitimate government need to realize that Adolf Hitler, in fact, was also elected and appointed democratically in January of 1933 until the coup d'etat, the burning of the Reichstag and so forth in March and May of 1933. Yes, you can be democratically elected and become a dictator after that. Gaza, the people are truly suffering, and there are no easy answers. And I don't claim to have any. Israel doesn't have any. The Arabs don't have any. Because they're ruled by a government, the Hamas government, that cares more about destroying Israel than they do about their people. And have made clear, in fact, that that is their goal, that is their ultimate goal, that's what they intend to do. And they don't seem to care about Israel's retaliation, not the government. The people do, though. And it is my hope and prayer on this 60th anniversary that the people of Gaza will rise up and throw out Hamas, which is doing terrible things to Gaza. And maybe the only way to do that is if Israel can reach some kind of deal with Abbas. There has to be a carrot and a stick, and a Palestinian state created in the West Bank would, I think, encourage those who are moderates in Gaza. But it's very, very hard to do. And it's very hard for Israel, it's hard for the Palestinians, it's hard for this entire situation. So I think on Israel's 60th anniversary, it's much like it was on its 10th anniversary 50 years ago. And that's why I was very interested in reading, looking at this old interview. And I encourage you to go to it, my website, radioinsidescoop.com, and play the old interview. It is hope and sadness. It is violence and peace. The Israeli economy is doing terrifically well. At the same time, it probably faces its greatest threat of nuclear annihilation ever in its history. So Israel always seems to be yin and yang. It seems to be good and bad. And I've always felt that Abba Eban's most famous statement was right on the mark. I don't remember when he made this statement, but Abba Eban, the person you heard in this interview, is most famous for his quotation that the Palestinian Arabs have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Again, whether that opportunity was in 1920 or 1939, 1947 or 1956, 1967, or in 1979 with the Camp David Accords where they were to get autonomy, or 2000, Camp David, or yes, even today in 2008, there are lots of opportunities that are being wasted. Some of this is Israel's fault. Some of this is the leadership of the Palestinian Arabs' fault. But at the end of the day, I think people need to recognize that half a loaf is better than no loaf at all. That two independent sovereign states, whatever the borders may be, is better than the current situation. And that neither side will get all they want. The Jewish nationalists are going to have to give up large portions, probably more than 90% of the West Bank. The Palestinian Arabs are going to have to recognize that Jerusalem, the center of Jewish prayer and nationalism for 2,000 years, will remain a Jewish city. Now, maybe a few Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem will not be. That can be negotiated. But each side has to give up a little. That is the essence of what negotiations are about. I don't think George Bush has any chance of creating that element of negotiation. I don't think his trip to Israel today will amount to much. I don't think that he will negotiate anything. My hope is, though, with a new president, President Obama, will be able to do the intense kind of negotiation and, yes, hand-holding, and, yes, recognizing Israeli security fears, recognizing that the Palestinians want a true, viable state, and will be able to give support to both groups so that we can finally have the two-state solution in the Middle East that, frankly, would have solved the problem back at the Chaim Weizmann King Faisal Agreement of 1920. Until then, I think the